With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Welcome to episode 38 of The Hylum, the pop culture and current affairs podcast brought to you by journalists Pandora Sykes and Dolly Alderton. So Dolly, what's been going on with you this week?
First of all, I'd like to issue an apology. I waxed lyrical about The Marvellous Miss Maisel, saying
yes,
it was a
Netflix
show.
Yes, you've got your platforms mixed up.
And I'm very embarrassed to say it's an Amazon Prime show. And that is embarrassing, actually, because they are very different.
And they've gone into liquidation now since you did that.
I'm so sorry, it's my cross to carry now for life. So anyway, you should watch that programme and it's on Amazon Prime. I have been pretty busy prepping and recovering from Pretendmas.
I genuinely think that was probably on the same scale of stress as me moving house.
Oh my God.
Because I know how seriously you take. I saw the Instagram stories.
2 a.m. making that food the night before. Then up with the lark, getting it all prepped. It was the best day of my life though. It was so good. It was so good. It was really, really fun. But I definitely eked out Pretendmas too long, so we were kind of drinking and eating all day, and then I went out dancing and drank tequila with sort of a massive roast dinner sloshing around in me.
It's a new thing, tequila.
It is, isn't it?
Everyone stinks of it.
Oh, yes, you said you went to a party recently and everyone just...
At the British Fashion Awards, yes, everyone on my table was drinking tequila, and you really noticed the... It's like paint stripper.
How's this
on
happened?
The
it's like how Aperol Spritz became a thing.
I think, well, with tequila, I think it started in New York because my friends in New York started drinking it about 18 months ago because they believe all that bullshit about agave having healing properties. And also tequila soda is low calorie.
I see. Oh, tequila soda, that must be horrible.
I think it probably is. But then I think vodka soda is disgusting too.
I don't sip a tequila. I just knock it back in like a student club night way.
Oh, so you have shots of tequila?
That's what I was doing on Saturday.
Oh, yeah, no, you're not new style.
Which I think
you're
you'll agree style. Was very Christmassy of me.
You are old style.
So, yes, that was Saturday. But I have been watching and listening to some great stuff. I went and saw a screening of Lady Bird, which is Greta Gerwig's directorial debut, which you are just going to adore. You're going to love it. And the fact as well that you're having a daughter, I think, will bring it even more poignancy for
you. And it's not got that sort of manic pixie dream girl quality about it.
Well, do you know what? It's sort of... Is it
screwball?
It's a little screwball, but Greta Gerwig is so known for that trope. It's a really clever film. And I think that that young character, she's a 17-year-old girl, the protagonist called Lady Bird. She kind of examines and inverts... and makes a pastiche of the manic pixie dream girl thing because Lady Bird wants to be a manic pixie dream girl.
Right.
So it's almost like a fun kind of self-reflective nod on the whole mumblecore, that kind of area of cinema. It's just such uncharted territory, I think, the relationship between mother and daughter, and it's so raw and painful.
She said on that Fresh Air podcast, didn't she, the one where they get into that whole sort of Woody Allen hullabaloo?
Yes.
She says that the woman interviewing her says, why does she choose to be called Lady Bird? And Greta Gerwig just says, well, it's a rejection of the entire identity that her mother has created for her. And actually, in a completely different way, this reminded me slightly of most members of my family who insist on calling me by my husband's surname.
That's
even though I've never taken it,
yeah.
Haven't changed it anywhere, written about how I haven't taken it. It doesn't upset me, but I find it very interesting that there is, in a family, I think there is an identity that you can't be malleable with it.
No.
Not with the nomenclature. What are your parents like about you calling yourself Dolly?
Well, I've asked them that a few times because I know...
Because your mum calls you Hanny.
Yeah, and I know how... painstakingly they chose my name. I was actually originally Dodie, and then my dad put his foot down.
That's
and changed
got a bit,
it to
you'd,
Hannah.
Be linked forever with
Hellfire.
Yes.
I know, it would have been terrible, but I've asked them. I said, do you mind that this is kind of a nickname that stuck and then became a nom de plume, and now it's kind of the name that every single person calls me. Only my family call me Hannah now. And they said, no, not at all. But my parents are very relaxed about that stuff. I don't think they'd be precious about that.
What about if you wanted to start calling yourself Ladybird?
It's so funny. As I watched it, I was like, I wonder if they think when I was 16 and I was like, everyone's calling me Dolly. I wondered if they thought she's doing a bit of a Ladybird.
You know, that like it might have been a phase.
Like I might have been doing a rejection of, you know, this is my personality.
Lots of my friends did that when they were younger. They kind of road tested their middle name as their first name and it sort of stuck for a term and then everyone went on summer holidays and forgot.
I remember as a teenager, and this is something that they do so well in Lady Bird, I hated being a teenager so vehemently. And I remember as a teenager thinking, I have so little control and power over my life. I can't drive. I can't earn money. I can't have sex. I can't drink. I can't have a job. I can't have anything of my own flat. So what can I do that makes me feel like I'm in charge of my own life? So I wonder if maybe it was that. Anyway, going away from my psychoanalysis and back to Lady Bird, it's a brilliant film. It's had a 100% score on Rotten Tomatoes, which
I've
is
never
like,
seen that.
Has broken all records, apparently. Yeah, it's
Isn't
really
it interesting
worth
how
seeing.
People, Rotten Tomatoes started out as kind of a bit of the sort of farcical, satirical riposte to IMDb. Now people go to Rotten Tomatoes over IMDb, don't they?
Yeah, and it's actually, when you go onto Wikipedia to look at the reception of a film, the first thing they say is Rotten Tomatoes.
Because the idea was obviously that it was films that were shit. Because
that's what I recall, yeah.
Yeah, it must have evolved. Yeah. And that's okay, they're allowed to. We'll give them that.
So yeah, beautiful film. Would encourage everyone to go see it. I've discovered The Grief Cast by Carrie Ad Lloyd. I'd listened to one episode before.
About that when we went to The Guilty Feminist.
Yes, I listened to one ages ago and I think I was feeling sad about a loss of mine. So I think I found it too difficult. But someone messaged me, I was looking for some podcasts and they said, try...
You are a podcast binge.
I'm a podcat.
You are a podcat.
They said, try listening to Griefcast. And this woman said to me, I lost my mother recently and it was the thing that carried me through. So I went and listened to Adam Buxton's, actually, as the first one that I listened to. And it is so truthful and poignant and moving and funny. And it captures the chaos and the catatonic sadness and the hysteria and madness of death. And it's, I really think that if I had listened to it during periods of grief, it would have really helped me. So Adam Buxton talks about his father, who passed away a couple of years ago. Well, it was only very recent when he did the recording, and it's just a really great episode. I'm really looking forward to listening to the whole series.
You might also enjoy, actually, on that note, Esther Perel has done live recordings of her therapist sessions.
Yeah.
I listened to one between a husband and wife who couldn't have a baby. And they're real life therapy sessions. It actually wasn't particularly for me. I think it might be more for you.
Mm.
You
I love Esther Perel. And also, I'm just so nosy. I love hearing about other people's relationships.
I'm very nosy. And I also love the idea of knowing someone's innermost
secrets. Yes, me too.
Awful confession.
Which is why we're journalists.
But it didn't grab me, that podcast. But it might. I'd be interested to see what you thought of it.
Okay, I'll listen to that and get back to you next week. I also listened to James Franco on WTF.
He's a strange man, isn't he?
Oh my God, he's not as strange as I thought he was. So in my head, I'm not really familiar with his work or him as an actor, but in my head I always thought he's a kind of kook. He's got these nutty things that he does.
He's a Joaquin Phoenix, isn't he? Or is he not as nuts as Joaquin?
He's really not. And actually, it's a really long conversation between him and Marc Maron. And it starts from a very interesting place because they had done a live podcast record for WTF about a year before at a film festival, and they'd hated each other and not got on well at all
and admitted it to
and
one
they
another.
First talk they talk about that as a starting point and why they both kind of rubbed up against each other the wrong way, which was really interesting. And he's just a fascinating guy, James Franco.
He's insanely intelligent, isn't he?
Yeah, so he found fame as an actor and he couldn't handle it, so he went back to school. And then I think he's still in school now.
I think he's doing multiple, like, quite hardcore sort of university courses. But there's more than that. There's his CV is really mad. I was looking at it the other day.
Yeah, there's this bit that I found so interesting that I didn't know about. Please forgive me, listeners, if this is common knowledge. I didn't know this. He is very immersive in his acting process, and he is kind of interested in the whole method acting thing. Mm. And he, I can't remember exactly why, I think he was playing a character who'd been in a soap Or for some reason, he wanted to know what being in a soap was like. So he got in touch with General Hospital, which in America is like...
It's like ER when George Clooney was on it.
It's even more naff. It's like doctors over here, like Holby City. And he applied, said, I would like to have a part. And he did nearly 30 episodes in this thing. So it's like, can you imagine? It's like Colin Firth or Bill Nighy kind of just popping up in Coronation Street.
These are interesting parallels with James Franco.
I was trying to think of someone who's like a serious English actor. Tom Hardy, maybe.
Colin Firth.
Tom Hardy appearing in like Holby City.
Nigel Havers.
who I referred to way too much in all of my writing. So anyway, that was very interesting. And then the final thing that I wanted to talk about is Sophie Hagen, who was the co-host of The Guilty Feminist in its earlier years. She's a very, very funny Danish comedian. I really love her work. She's done this podcast. It's called Made of Human, and she interviews people to kind of investigate the human condition and the fragility of humans and why we are the way we are.
That's very interesting.
It's so good. And there's one particular episode that I've now listened to twice. It was so good, with Jo Brand, who's a comedian who I love. Sorry to be a broken record. Her Desert Island Discs is very, very good. And there's the whole thing's really interesting. She talks about how before she went into comedy, she worked in a psychiatric unit of a hospital in an emergency ward. And she talks about what she learned about humans from doing that job. She talks about how she was as a teenager. She was a runaway from home. She had a heroin addict boyfriend. She talks about her weight. It's just a really, really good podcast episode. Really good conversation.
She's got a life experience to mine.
She really has. And there's a section that she says at the end that I found very true and moving that I'd like to insert here, where Sophie Hagen says to her, if you could go into the room where you have just been born and hold baby Jo Brand in your arms and say one thing to her, what would you say?
I would say, work very hard on your friendships, because in the long run, they are what really count in a way, because they sort of anchor you all through the stages of your life. You have children, then they grow up and leave home. You get married. Maybe you stay in that marriage, but it probably changes by its very nature. But with friends, a good friend for life, there's just nothing like it. So I would say work very hard on it, and also give them a bit of slack if they're annoying, because everyone's friends are annoying now and then. I'm annoying now and then. I know it's hard to believe, but I am really annoying. You know, but friendships are just so important to me.
Some great recommendations. I'm definitely going to check out James Franco. So as my life is in boxes, I haven't done a huge amount of reading except for a bit of The Fallout by Sadie Jones, which isn't particularly a new book, but I am loving that already. I have, however, read some brilliant journalism this week. Firstly, Terry White on women's refuges, a third of which are facing closure in the UK. This is totally devastating. And I tweeted recently, actually, that I don't believe enough is being written about the need for refuges for battered and or vulnerable women and children. Mm. And Terry's piece therefore struck a lot of chords with a lot of people. Terry's the editor of Empire magazine, and she writes for The Pull about how she escaped to a women's refuge with her mum to escape a violent boyfriend of her mum's, who we gather is not the first violent boyfriend that Terry has encountered, when she was a young child. And this is a little excerpt. So our turn to go home came 6 weeks after that unremarkable day, when news arrived that he'd left our home for good, that he'd realised it was over. One day, soon after we'd returned, the second paving slab rocking more gently now, a neighbour shouted over, "We would hear you all screaming." We thought about calling the police, but we didn't want to interfere. We didn't want to interfere. We didn't want to interfere. We're not going to interfere. I'm here to tell you that a lack of interference can kill. That neighbour may have not felt able, inclined or otherwise to intervene, but I have sent up a silent prayer of thanks to someone or anyone on many nights that our first shimmer of good luck meant we were given a room in a refuge, that we were saved. I've played the alternative scenario in my head 100 times or more. At best, the beatings continue for a while longer before we get another opportunity to leave. The worst, he kills my mum. Her death is a bleak reality I could face were I a child today. So it's a wonderful story. And I actually emailed Terry and she said it felt like a layer of her skin had been ripped off.
But understandably.
That she felt like the kind of catharsis, but also just the putting it into, you know, the public domain would how hopefully be the payoff.
And how useful that is. But my heart broke reading it. And I really commend her bravery and vulnerability in sharing something so personal.
It's the first personal story I'd read about a woman's refuge, actually. Mm. The news stories, as I said, had not been multiple, if anything, the opposite. And they'd all been quite abstract.
That's,
you know, I don't know anyone who grew up in a women's refuge.
No.
I feel deeply about it, but I'm not knowledgeable at grassroots about it. So I think what Terry does is she brings that story to us who are too privileged to ever have known anyone until we read Terry's story, who had experienced that upbringing.
And bring faces to it and feelings to it.
Exactly,
you know.
Faces and feelings. I've also been left really upset by a news story this week. In fact, I actually can't stop thinking about it. I'm sure many of you listening will also be familiar with it because it's just horrible. So a woman was run over and killed by four cars in a row, none of which stopped whilst walking across a pedestrian crossing in Tulse Hill earlier this week. Have you seen that story?
I haven't.
So four cars, well, two vans and two cars, all hit her one after another while she was walking across a pedestrian crossing, and not one stopped to see if she was all right, which she wasn't. She died. And I just cannot believe the probability of four ethically redundant people driving in a row. Honestly, I am left reeling that four cars in a row could all contain people who had no moral compass and no regard for the value of life. I actually tweeted, what are the chances of having four see you next Tuesdays driving in a row? And so many people tweeted back being like, I mean, clearly quite high.
Yeah, it does make you sort of lose faith a bit.
I just don't know how it's possible. But in lighter news, because this is the high-low and there is always a lighter story to help us deal with the really vile stories in the world, the second piece of journalism that I recommend from this week, aka my favourite story of 2017, which I tweeted.
I didn't get to read it. Tell me what
so
it is.
So it was on Vice and it's about a woman who made her imaginary garden shed restaurant the number one rated restaurant on TripAdvisor. It's completely improbable. I'll share the link. But totally understandable because she explains at every single step how she did it. So Ubar Butler takes you pictorially and narratively through the entire bizarre and brilliant story, which includes listing the food in her restaurant, which is called The Shed at Dulwich, and sharing pictures of the food, which she shows the snapshot of what you would see on TripAdvisor, and then she scales out and you can see that it's never food. It's Gillette shaving foam, or for example, what looks like a chicken breast is actually her heel, which is resting on
that's
a plate.
Hilarious.
She built the shed itself in her garden and you see pictures of her building it and acquiring chickens. And then for the first opening night, she spent £31 on ingredients from Iceland.
But wait, were there ever any customers?
Yes. What's even more insane is after customers came, she managed to stay in the top spot for 2 weeks, which just shows what modern society will do for hype. It's completely insane. Please, everyone, read it. It's not only very funny, it's very, very clever.
And it also probably says a lot about trends and the Emperor's new clothes.
Oh, I mean, the shed
internet
in Dulwich. That tells you everything you
exactly
need to know. I'm really behind, I know, but I am completely hooked on The People versus O.J. Simpson.
Oh,
American
love
crime
that
story on
show.
Netflix. How did it take me so long to get to it?
Because
you watched it,
so
didn't you?
So good.
David Schwimmer is sublime as the reediest, most pathetic best friend who just can't quite abandon the celebrity, even when he knows his friend did it.
Have you seen the compilation of him on YouTube calling O.J. Simpson juice?
No.
It's just over and over again. Juice.
The general consensus is that he did it from that show, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, they think that show is not being ambiguous about whether or not they think he did it.
Yeah, and that man, Robert Kardashian, I went obviously on like a Wikipedia Robert Kardashian
really
after I watched that incredibly hammy but incredibly compelling show.
Well, I mean, amazing characters, isn't it, full stop?
But he said, he was quoted of saying, I think he probably did it years after.
Because
afterwards.
I feel like the show makes no bones about the fact that he very obviously did it. But I don't know if that's because I think he did it.
I'm getting quite nervy about saying all this, but O.J. Simpson's not listening, is he? we're all right, Charlie, aren't we?
It also shows how jurors react to different people, empathise with different emotions. You know, there's this really poignant, but you can see why he says it, this really poignant bit where someone says to Marsha, who's the prosecutor...
Played brilliantly.
You might want to soften your lip. You might want to soften your hairstyle. Stop wearing pantsuits. Smile a bit. And she's livid because of course, it's very sexist, but it's also quite practical advice because an imaginary jury's just come back and none of the women empathise with her. Mm. None of the women are responding to her emotionally, which again gets us into a whole quagmire about whether or not people are, you know, sent down for their crimes or because of how persuasive you find the prosecutor or the defendant. Anyway, I'm really, really enjoying that. I'm also watching a whole host of complete crap on Netflix, which I can't even tell you what I'm watching. But if you are looking for really light-hearted rubbish, my God, Netflix has it in spades. There's so many crap series on there. On a complete side note, did you see that Harry Styles stepped in to host The Late Late Show with James Corden after James's wife went into labour 2 hours before the show? So I'm riveted by this. Is he going to go into presenting? Is he going to be the new Jack Whitehall?
He doesn't ever seem... I haven't watched masses of Harry Styles on camera, but he never seems that relaxed.
He went down very well on The Late Show with James Corden. Watch this space. We had some funny emails for some readers. Dolly, do you want to kick us off?
I listened to episode 37 of your splendid podcast, and upon your mention of the word gusset, I wish to bring to your attention to something I thought you might like. It's a piece of graffiti written in very big letters that, for many years, graced the side of a building between London Bridge and Waterloo East. Us South East Londoners fondly remember seeing it on the train route into London. Sadly, the daubing has since gone, but the memories remain. I bring you Big Dave's gusset, which we will post the picture on the Hilo's Twitter. There's a bit of a mystery around the identity of Big Dave, or what the story is behind the celebrated gusset. But I guess that's part of the joy of Big Dave's gusset, simply in its very existence. Photos attached. Thanks, Alice. We will tweet the picture, and if anyone knows who Dave is or his gusset, get in touch.
We also received a tale of frustration from Laurie. I was wondering if you could help me with a reoccurring issue I'm having at work. As my name is unisex, it's sometimes difficult to judge by email, if you've never met me before, as to whether I am male or female. One of my colleagues, who I have not yet met, keeps referring to me as fella. He repeatedly signs his emails off as, "Cheers, fella. Much appreciated, fella. And when you get a chance, fella." I am yet to correct him, as I am not sure how to address the subject without sending a photograph of my face and a pissed off note saying, "I am a woman dipstick." Regardless of whether I am male or female, I find this really derogatory and a rude way of addressing someone you've never met. What do you think I should do? So obviously this is quite comical. I don't actually think that Laurie's a particularly unisex name, but parking that, I don't think you need to send a pissed off note saying, "I'm a woman dipstick," although I can understand why fella is so random. It's like the 80s.
It's so weird.
I understand why fella's annoying you. I just think reply and be like, "By the way, Dave, just to let you know, I'm actually a woman."
Such a strange email to have to send.
He might then start responding with
"bird,"
"babe," or something.
All right, bird.
But I wouldn't let it bother you.
Or you could do a Mel Gibson in What Women Want and pretend you are a man and then get all the intel of how men talk to each other.
You could also do that.
Support for the Hilo comes from Google Pixel 2. Google has been built on asking questions and challenging the status quo. From search to email and maps and beyond, Google has a history of questioning the norm and finding a better way.
Each week, we will do a curiosity challenge in which Dolly or I pose a question to one another, encompassing the Hilo's ethos of covering all things from the personal to the philosophical to the surreal. This week, Dolly, my question to you, in light of Time magazine's Person of the Year, who is your Person of the Year?
Now, someone suggested this on Twitter, and I have to say I agree with them. For me, the overlooked and unsung hero of 2017 has to be Marion from the Robert Kelly BBC interview.
Oh, for God's sake.
You will probably remember the story. An American academic was interviewed live on the BBC about South Korea from his home. When his young daughter Marion came into the study doing a very peppy little walk, she became a star overnight, quite rightly. And I do believe she should have been Time's Person of the Year. Her rakish manner to me represents how we should all walk through life, particularly in these uncertain times.
You described yourself as Marion, didn't you? And me as the harried mother coming in to grab her.
You told me I was the baby in the walker. Like the Boris Johnson baby.
And I'm the mother.
You're the harassed
mother.
Presumed
to be the nanny.
Yes, exactly.
You're so obsessed with Marion.
I love her. If you see your person of the year out and about, don't forget to snap them with a Google Pixel 2. We shared another picture from our Google Pixel 2 series, shot a few months ago at the Savoy Hotel, on our Instagram account. So if you want to see Pandora and I in the nude, head on over. The Google Pixel 2 has the world's best smartphone camera, giving you the very best ever pictures, whether it's a sunny day or a starry night.
Thank you very much to our pretty partner, Google Pixel 2. It's now time for the top line, read by Dolly Hannah Alderton.
Do we want another festive tune? Let's have another festive tune.
Yeah, we
CJ.
Had Dave last week, so yeah. It's CJ's turn to get the festive out.
This is the top line. A project called Clitorosity has been taking the world by storm as 92 chalk drawings of the clitoris have popped up across the states, UK and Denmark. The brainchild of 24-year-old Laura Kingsley, there are 80 contributors who hope to get people having frank conversations about female pleasure. You can follow the collective at Clitorosity. A baby born with her heart outside of her body has received surgery to put her heart back into her chest. Vanellope Wilkins was born 3 weeks ago via caesarean without a chest bone and is the first baby in the UK to ever survive this condition. New mothers could be given a £200 incentive to breastfeed following a trial conducted by Public Health England. More than 10,000 women took part in the trial and breastfeeding rose by 6%. A study has revealed that 90% of the world's plastic waste is carried by just 10 rivers in Africa, India and China. The Nile, the Ganges and the Yangtze are among the culprits due to their long banks. The Yangtze carries up to 1.5 million tonnes of plastic into the ocean every year, compared to the 18 tonnes from the Thames. Michael Gove has announced that foreign aid cash will be used to tackle the impact of the clog on marine life. 5 people have been arrested on suspicion of murder after a house fire in Salford killed 3 children earlier this week and left the mother and 3-year-old in critical condition. The 3 men and 2 women are aged between 18 and 24. A backlash has begun after a young boy in the States shared a video about how he was being bullied about his nose. The video of Keaton Jones has had over 20 million views since his mother shared it on Friday. But Kimberly Jones now faces accusations of child exploitation after revealing that the $57,000 raised by GoFundMe page will be spent on Christmas presents. Pictures have also surfaced of the family with Confederate flags. Relationships charity Relate has recently revealed that single men feel more pressure to find a partner than their female counterparts, with over 70% of single men claiming that they feel significant pressure to couple up, compared to 58% of single women. Results reveal that younger respondents were also more likely to report feeling pressure to find a relationship than older ones. The world's first biodegradable pregnancy test will be on shelves in 2018. The test, called Leah, which translates as bearer of good news, works like a standard pregnancy test, except it can also be flushed down the loo after use. London's Euston Station will be turned into a shelter for the homeless on Christmas Day. The station will be filled with decorations and tables set for a full festive dinner on the 25th of December. Rail workers and charity staff will serve food to 200 rough sleepers invited to the event. 21-year-old Egyptian pop singer Shaima Ahmed, who goes professionally by Shaima, has been jailed for 2 years and fined £10,000 for eating fruit in a suggestive way in her music video. The video features the singer eating an apple and a banana in her underwear in front of a classroom of young men, and Shaima has been accused of inciting debauchery. And that was the top line.
That's awful about Shaima Ahmed. So she's sort of a Miley Cyrus type and she's been jailed for 2 years. I'm really torn on the breastfeeding incentive. You know, breastfeeding sounds fucking tough, as I'm soon to discover. And I love the idea of women being rewarded for it. But equally, we do have an issue with breastfeeding sort of tyranny here.
Definitely.
Where this idea of breast is best can be really detrimental for a woman's mental health. And not every woman can do it. And I worry that it's already fetishized quite a lot. And that whole Mumsnet community is fucking nuts about stuff like that. Very judgy on, you know, who does it and how long you do it for. But the health benefits of breastfeeding are huge for the baby, with all the nutrients, to foster the bond between mother and child, for the woman's own mental health. And also, much less importantly, it can help shift baby weight, which, you know, a lot of women feel conscious of when they have a baby. My sister, who's a midwife, always says, if you can, it's great. If you can't, your mental health is more important. Mm. So, I mean, it rose by 6% because some of these 10,000 women wanted the £200 shopping voucher.
It makes me feel very uncomfortable.
I'm really conflicted on it. Mm. I'm really conflicted on it. A New Yorker short story named Cat Person has gone viral. If you're looking for a water cooler topic this week, this short story might be it.
Cat Person tells the tale of a young woman named Margot who begins a flirtation with an old man named Robert. The story goes on to describe a disappointing date between the two, a strange but very familiar dynamic of power and role play begins to unfold, followed by some disappointing, quite graphic sex, and ending with Margot losing interest in Robert. The story finishes sharply with Robert spotting Margot out sometime later and asking why she ended things with him so abruptly and whether or not she is sleeping with the guy he saw her with in the bar and calls her a whore. Pandora, there's been a huge amount of commentary and hype around this story. It's really captured something very timely about a certain dynamic, I think, between a certain type of older man and a young woman. What did you make of it?
On an artistic level, I just loved it as a modern short story. Mm. As you know, the short story is my favourite medium, and this is an excellent example of a great one. And this was an excellent example of one. As fellow New Yorker writer and TV critic Emily Nussbaum summarised, it is witty, insightful and unpretentious.
I totally loved this story. Some people have been slightly snobby about it, I think, saying, well, it's just quite an average short story and surely people have read a short story before. And sure, I don't think the writing style is hugely avant-garde or new and experimental in the way it uses language specifically, but it's got that great New Yorker fiction style of really clean prose, sharp dialogue, and most importantly, three-dimensional, very recognisable, fantastically formed characters.
I also find that kind of riposte really funny, like when someone goes into an art gallery and goes, well, I could do that.
Oh, I hate
it. It's like, sure, okay, you could, but you didn't.
And you didn't have the idea.
And that doesn't make it invalid. Short stories really make an impact for me. They don't always make an impact. I'm struggling with Sour Heart, for example, as I revealed last week. But when they address a central, possibly quite obvious truth, then yeah, that makes a real impact for me. And I'd take that over surrealism any day.
I think the reason it struck such a chord is I think most women have known a Robert in their lives and most women have been a Margot. A lot of women at some point have entered into a dynamic they don't feel hugely comfortable in because they want to accommodate the man or they feel they need the gaze of desire on them. It's like both the characters are getting off on playing. It's like a certain hackneyed heterosexual role and they have absolutely no respect for each other. He likes to think she's a young virgin. He kisses her head in a paternal way. He patronisingly jokes about her being too drunk or not studying hard enough as if she's kind of a childlike ingenue when she's 20. And in turn, she likes to think of him as this sort of older, worldly beast of a man. In fact, I think one of the most intelligently observed passages of it, and I've spoken to a lot of women who said exactly the same, that this was the standout moment, is the moment when she's having sex with him and she's not turned on at all. So she has to think about him, thinking about how amazing she is and marvelling at her youth and beauty. That's the only way that she can kind of get off. At that moment, it's totally about their egos. And I've never read about that before. The way, as a young, curious, insecure woman, you can enter into this contract with an equally insecure older man who should really know better.
Totally. I think it's really important, because conflation is not only lazy but inevitable, that we distinguish between this story, which is a telling of a woman feeling like it is her duty to place her pleasure secondary to a man, and the Me Too movement. Me Too is about assault forgotten female pleasure, whilst something accepted by young women, certainly in abundance when I was at university, is a result of sexism, but it is not the grave danger of Weinstein, etc. Because this story has followed quite closely in relation to the first movement, some people have tried to tie it together. And whilst I think that leaves a climate where we are more receptive to a short story like this and the, you know, effects of sexism in society on women, these are very separate things. So disclaimer or clarification, if you will, aside, as a former dating columnist, Dolly, is this something you've written about before? I'm actually racking my brains as to if you have, trying to recall all these beautiful little columns of your youth.
I wrote about a bloke who snogged me and... I think I still have PTSD from the incident because he sort of ate my face like the first bite of a burrito. Just
such a good lie.
Chomped it right down. His top lip went over my nostrils and I definitely hung there slightly longer than I would because I didn't want to hurt his feelings. I wrote about that in my column. And then Farley said...
I'm dying.
And then I didn't want to see him again, obviously, because I didn't want to see... how that would translate into the bedroom
area. You didn't
want
to be the human burrito.
Exactly. And I said...
Imagine you'd have been a tortilla.
Oh, God. And Farley said she thinks I should send him a letter telling him that what he did was unacceptable.
I mean, I wouldn't probably waste your time.
Anyway, back to Cat Person. There have been a lot of comment pieces from women around the issues of consent and coercion in dating and sex. The BBC journalist Felicity Morse wrote a fantastic piece for The Debrief, and a very brave piece, in which she details moments in her younger life she's had sex when she really hasn't wanted to, and exactly why that happened. She hasn't wanted to emasculate the guy, she didn't want to hurt his feelings, and this is another part of the story that I think has again really struck a chord with a lot of women, and I hope men too, about how much we culturally enshrine and make sacred the male sexual pride and ego. A lot of women, myself included, are absolutely, or have been absolutely, terrified of hurting a man's feelings. Perhaps it's because we're so used to seeing them as figures of authority, but I think it might be more of a survival instinct because we're scared of what they might do if they feel exposed or embarrassed. But for whatever reason, it is something we really handle with care. When you think about the number of times you've lied to a man who's pursued you and said you had a boyfriend when you haven't because you don't want to say you're not interested and you don't want to hurt his feelings, or even more intimately, think of the number of stories you hear from your friends about times when their sexual partner or boyfriend couldn't perform in bed and they turned really moody or nasty. It's a big problem for which the oppressive culture of toxic masculinity is just as much to blame and damages men just as much as women. And Cat Person really delves into that. There are moments in which she lets Robert behave badly or break her boundaries because she's so worried about hurting him.
It's something you see very much in girls. Obviously, Lena Dunham is a slightly dirty word in cultural discussions of the now, but Adam Driver's character is an odious character initially in that series. The role of when he plays the role of her boyfriend, when he's just, you know, he's pummeling her. He really doesn't care if she's having good sex or not. But I think that's a good point you make about the fact that toxic masculinity damages men as much as women, because this isn't just, this isn't just women who are scared of being abused by a man. It's also, in many cases, a man feeling immense pressure to be this kind of sexual god.
Totally.
And what you have is... a scenario where a lot of people, when they're younger, are both kind of miserable in the roles that have been imposed upon them by society.
Exactly.
I've read a lot of very similar stories of this ilk. Hayley Narman wrote a good one on Man Repeller. Ella Dawson, the social media editor at TED, wrote one on her site. I think it's something that happens much more when you are younger than we are now. I don't think either of us would be in that position, no pun intended, now.
Yeah.
And to that end, Margot is 20 years old and a college student, and I would say that's the time where that was pretty rote.
Oh, definitely.
Women having terrible sex. I think it was more unusual for women to be having great sex when they felt really comfortable than it is for them to be having what Margot and Robert enter into.
Of course, there has been the inevitable backlash to this piece. Some people have said it's fatphobic because Margot's character has thoughts of slight disgust and repulsion at Robert's body when he's undressed for the first time. I understand how this might be upsetting for an overweight person to read. Truly, I do understand that. But I must say, I really don't think the story is fatphobic. And I really think it's necessary in capturing a very delicate and specific relationship and thought process within that world, that fictional world. Did you think it was a fatphobic story?
What I would say is, even if she is fatphobic, that's, you know, I think we can't get to the point where we're criticising the machinations of a story in the same way that, you know, when you often read kind of, I don't know, American crime written by a man, there might be a woman who's got fake tits and it's literally written like that. You know, her fake tits were juggling and her platinum blonde hair was doing this. Like, it's a story. It's a description. No one said that these people had to be 100% PC. I don't really... I find that really odd. So what if it's fatphobic? Doesn't mean it's not an interesting story. You know, no one said that these were kind of morally and politically impeccable characters. So it's written from Margot's perspective and she is analysing the body that she is about to let penetrate her, to be visceral about it. So I think it's just a very honest narrative about the thoughts you have when you're evaluating a partner's body for the first time. And to be honest, her voice makes it quite clear that the soft, hairy fold of skin wouldn't bother her if she fancied him. It's when he beetle scuttles off to the loo with the condom falling off after a bout of spectacularly bad porno-style sex that she's looking at him with revulsion. But she's not looking at him with revulsion because he's soft around the edges. She's looking at him with revulsion because she realises that they are not and will never be well-matched mates. Even though it's not written first person, it's written in the third person, it's from Margot's point of view. So there is this honesty about the ego involved. I mean, we both loved that bit where Margot admits that she's being spectacularly egotistic, imagining how hot Robert must find her. In fact, you know, it's imagining what Robert thinks of her young, febrile body that allows her to kind of go through with the intercourse. And I think that's pretty honest and totally riveting to read because sex is fucking weird. We so rarely know the inner workings of anyone's mind. You know, you can know everything about a friend, but you don't have a clue what they think about when they have sex. This might be a bit weird.
No,
If you took each other through that process. And also, all the great rows in the world are about religion and sex, pretty much. So, you know, when it comes to sex, it's this fascinating field to explore. And I was riveted to be allowed access to this, albeit fictional, moment.
And inner workings of sexuality. Yeah. I was with the journalist and friend of the High Lows, Laura Snapes, yesterday. And she said something really smart on this subject, going back to the fatphobic thing. We can't read this short story as if it were an essay or a piece of journalism.
That's exactly what I mean when we're criticising a character.
Yeah, it's a piece of fiction and we can't hold the inner dialogue of a fictional character's head to moral account as if she were a journalist or an MP or a public figure.
Absolutely.
It's completely insane. Everyone has had judgmental or unsavoury thoughts about their fellow man. I've probably had about 5 this morning. The whole point and profundity of fiction is that it can access these areas of the human condition and the inner workings of a human mind and expose these truths that would otherwise never or rarely be explored in non-fiction or reporting or reality. I think we're in a really dangerous place if we lose all nuance in art and storytelling because we're worried that all the characters and the inner worlds of the respective characters have to be supposedly morally clean.
Absolutely. And I think on the subject of interior monologues, you know, the interior monologue of most people is utterly, utterly vile. And I don't think that's a problem. I think it's a problem when this leaks out to the exterior. We shouldn't share that kind of stuff. Mm. And that's what I think we see a lot of now on social media, is people seem to think that we've kind of created this slightly permissive society where you can actually just kind of spew out your poisonous interior thoughts onto someone else's platform, account, page, because you're not being held visibly accountable. And not only is it cowardice, but it just goes back to that adage that if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say it at all, except in fiction. That's where you can say it.
A Twitter account has been set up to document some of the most hilarious, ignorant and baffled tweets of men reacting to the story called @mencatperson. The reaction, I would say, from where I've been standing has been more strong and all-encompassing from women, which would make sense as it's more from the point of view and mindset of Margot. Journalist Amy Jones touched on why this has been more poignant and resonated more with women in a fantastic piece for The Pool, which I'm going to quote from now. Do men often get into a car and not know whether they'll get out alive? Do their friends instinctively know to surround them in a bar to protect them from a dodgy one-night stand? How many men go on dates wondering whether they'll meet the love of their life, be murdered, or be called a whore for ignoring a string of texts afterwards? These things will happen to some men, definitely. They happen to almost all women.
Yes, definitely. And if she hadn't been called a whore and she'd left, she would have been called a cock tease. I can, playing devil's avocado, I can see why men reading it probably wouldn't, you know, feel delightful afterwards, because it is a story where Margot comes out much better. Mm. It's not a particularly pleasant read for men. Mm. But I think the reason why Margot's story is creating such waves is because you read a lot about the clingy, insecure, mentally fragile, bonkers, quote-unquote, woman who shags a man and then wants to marry him. But you don't read that much about the slightly creepy, miserable older man who really wants to pursue something with a college girl who's not that into it. So it's more just, it's a dynamic we haven't seen explored, and that makes people feel uncomfortable.
And also, I think the reason people feel relieved to read this is anyone who's watched pornography in their life has watched a woman
being pounded
doing this performance that Margot did. So, you know, I think that's another reason why there's a sense of relief. You know, if I'd read this in my early 20s or my late teens, I think it would have really changed the way that I conducted myself with boys. So I think it's a really, really useful piece. We would love to hear if you're a man who's read it. I must say the men I know have responded just as I have to it. In fact, it was a man who sent it to me. They really loved it and found it very confronting. Are you a man who's read Cat Person and you have some thoughts, or are you a woman? We'd love to hear from all of you. You can email us on thehilowshow@gmail.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Support for the Hilo comes from Papier. We are thrilled to have Papier as a sponsor, as Pandora and I love their products, but we're particularly thrilled this week to be telling you about Papier's personalised stationery sets, as they are our Christmas presents to each other.
I've actually got you another Christmas present as well.
Oh, have you?
I wrote on your Instagram that you'd spoiled it slightly. Did you see that?
Yes, I did.
We'll see why. Personalised stationery makes the perfect gift this Christmas, whether it's the lined notebooks for the studious, which are priced at $12.99, the sketchbooks for the arty, priced at $8.99, or the note cards, which are $17.99 for a set of 10. We're both getting each other the classic border set, which comes in a range of really stylish colours with our names printed at the top. And as you can gather, these are not a surprise.
Not both of our names, to be clear. This isn't a round robin from a married couple situation.
We should get some that say the Hilo, though.
Oh, that's a good idea. Picked from hundreds of designs by top designers, including Luke Edward Hall and Mother of Pearl, as well as iconic brands such as the V&A and Moomin. We're both pretty taken with the Luke Edward Hall one, aren't we, Panda?
Oh, yes, I love Luke Edward Hall. He's a young interior designer that is doing really, really well at the moment. The millennial pink and botanicals are right up your street, Dolly.
Yeah, love them.
Every design can be personalised, and everything is printed on lovely, high-quality papier paper. Hilo listeners can enjoy a 15% discount across all Papier products when they use Hilo, HIGHLOW in capitals, at the checkout. Thanks very much to Papier. A former Facebook exec has given a speech at Stanford University in the States where he warned that social media is ripping society apart. Chamath Palihapitiya, who joined Facebook in 2007 and became VP for User Growth, i.e. luring more of us to use the platform, before leaving in 2011, has said that he feels tremendous guilt about the company that he helped build. He says that it helped cultivate a climate where there is no civil discourse, no cooperation, misinformation and mistruth. I listened to part of the speech on Radio 4 on Tuesday and I was just riveted by what he was saying. And it's not just something that affects the first world. It affects the richest to the poorest in myriad different ways. Here's a little excerpt that I found particularly arresting about what happened when a WhatsApp hoax ripped through a village in India.
People were like afraid that their kids were going to get kidnapped, etc. And then there were these lynchings that happened as a result, where people were like vigilante running around. They think they found the person and they, I mean, seriously? Like, that's what we're dealing with. You know, imagine like when you take that to the extreme, where, you know, bad actors can now manipulate large swaths of people to do anything you want.
I found this speech incredibly chilling. We all know this stuff anyway. Mm-hmm. We all know how social media and living a digital virtual existence alongside a real flesh and blood existence can be highly destructive. But there's also always a part of me that shrugs off that notion and thinks, chill out, it's fine, it's like chocolate, have it in moderation and it won't cause any huge damage. You know, people who say all that other stuff are hysterical or conspiratorial. But when the words are coming from the man with the intel, the man who designed these online worlds in which we spend the majority of our lives, that's even more chilling, and you can't ignore that. This is a slightly clumsy comparison, but it's like there's this doner kebab shop in Camden that every time I walk past it, the man who cuts the meat and works in the shop slices off these ribbons of grey meat, and he looks absolutely disgusted. And I always think, if I were a customer at this place, I would not be eating the meat if the man who cooks it pulls a face like that.
I don't think that's a clunky comparison at all. I think that's brilliant.
Thanks,
actually,
babe.
And I'd say for his own sake, he should just slap a smile. This is not, of course, the first time we've discussed the danger of social media. It's something I personally have written about quite a lot. It's not even the first time one of the head honchos of a social networking site has come out to deride it. Sean Parker, who helped create the like button at Facebook, has described the platform as knowingly exploiting the vulnerability in human psychology. He recently compared Snapchat to heroin and said that he uses blockers to prevent himself from spending too much time online and on social media. There have been loads of stories about top tech execs, including Melinda and Bill Gates, who banned their kids from having smartphones until the age of 14. A lot of the discussions in regards to social media revolve around dopamine. For those of you that aren't familiar with dopamine, it is a chemical neurotransmitter that gives you an instant hit. So when you like something or receive a like, you get this little jolt of pleasure and it's addictive and you want to do it again. But with the highs come the lows, and like a sugar crash, you're also left craving another hit. So it makes you feel quite desperate, quite brittle, quite fragile.
And you can actually sometimes feel that hit. I've actually physically felt that hit.
Of course you can. It's when someone goes back in and refreshes their picture and sees that it's got loads of likes. I actually recently wrote a piece for a glossy, which is yet to come out, so I can't actually give any details, about the changes I had made on a personal level with Instagram. Just for an example, I took a 2-week break in September and I now have a few rules with myself, like trying to post not more than every other day. Sometimes I break that if I'm away somewhere lovely, but I try and not post a picture more than every other day so that I'm not being too active in what I'm putting out there. Having been very active on the platform before, I try and limit my time on Instagram to one scroll in the morning, one scroll in the evening.
I know
that sounds plenty, but count how many times you do it per day and you'll soon see how few actually, being quite ascetic, checking in the morning and the evening. And I've made overall general changes to my phone, not just Instagram. My phone goes to bed before me around 9 p.m. My phone gets up later than me, normally an hour later, so around 8:30. I airplane my phone a lot. I mute my WhatsApp a lot. I read a brilliant book called How to Break Up With Your Phone by Catherine Price, which I think comes out in February. And if you have problems with your phone or social media or anything like that, I cannot recommend this book enough. You just need to create distance.
Yeah, it's exact. I mean, I'm still learning. I think you're ahead of me. I really need to get more of a routine and some rules in place and some boundaries with it. And as you said, the key, as it is with anything, as I learn as I get older, is that with anything that's pleasurable in life, be it sex, alcohol, pizza, it's just about balance. Otherwise, you're addicted to the thing. And to be addicted means that the thing has become bigger than you, that you are powerless to it. And I think a lot of us, me included, have that tendency with social media. It's as if it's a sort of force that we have no control over, which just is not the case. It's a ludicrous way to think that way. For example, yesterday I was on deadline for a piece that I was finding quite hard to write. And in my head, I thought, okay, you can check and scroll through Twitter in an hour once you've finished it. Then I got stuck on a particularly difficult sentence and I found my hand just typing in the Twitter homepage address. And in my head, I just thought, oh, well, I suppose this is happening now. I'm going to spend 10 minutes scrolling through Twitter and not write this piece for a little while longer. But it's almost as if my head was convincing myself that my hand was working as a law unto itself that I had no control over.
A research fellow at Oxford called Bernie Hogan was actually really interesting on Chamath's story, and you could say quite reassuring. He said that technological moral panics, quote unquote, have existed ever since the dawn of technology. And he gave what he describes as quite a gendered example of when the at-home telephone was installed. And there was this real fear that women would spend too much time cotching on the blower, gassing, as opposed to, you know, presumably cooking or cleaning, as was their role. And the same thing then happened with the creation of the internet, with email. You know, every time these things happen, we have this technological moral panic. Arguably, society has not kind of, the ructions in society have not been so pervasive and more just from a kind of time consuming point of view as with social media. I don't really use Facebook. I don't think it's that popular with our generation personally. I stay on it for birthday alerts as I never remember. I don't actually even remember my own husband's. I just know that it is one of 2 days. That's not to say I don't think Facebook's dangerous. I think politically it's actually the worst. For example, that Russian firm that spent $100,000 on fake ads to spread misinformation last year that ultimately aided the Trump campaign. Mm. And the damage that Facebook did in marking a Rohingya group on Facebook as a dangerous insurgency when the Muslim minority is being ethnically cleansed in Myanmar. What social media platform do you think is the most dangerous, Dolly, both personally and societally?
Well, for both, I think Instagram can be really dangerous. This is an embarrassing thing to expose, but in the spirit of true openness on this subject, I will expose it. I've had to really have a word with myself this year about Instagram. I hadn't realised how dependent I'd become on it. I had one particular week where I had loads and loads and loads of work going on, and I was just on my computer non-stop. I was either writing or I was filing or I was posting about stuff I'd written or I was pitching to editors. And in my head, I was really miserable. And in my head, I kept thinking to myself, I just want to be in the real world. I don't want to be writing until 2 a.m. in front of my computer. I just want to be with my friends. I hate this online existence I've created for myself. And then finally, at the end of the week on the Friday night, all my work was done and I had dinner with some friends. And within half an hour, where did I find myself but going to the loo so I could check my emails and scroll through my Twitter and Instagram. And it was a really sad moment. And I just thought to myself, you have to get a handle on this because you'll be forever dissatisfied if the real world isn't enough. And then when you're online, you're craving the real world. And I'm sure I was only doing that because I'd had a whole week of non-stop waiting for emails from editors and comments and likes and shares. And I had unconsciously become slightly dependent on that high and that process.
I think that's really honest of you to reveal that. You absolutely won't be alone in that. I have 100% had periods of that. I can honestly, hand on heart, now say I don't have that relationship with Instagram. But that came for me from a real point of resistance because I have a modest following on Instagram. I was so used to people thinking that I was more obsessed with it than I was.
Yeah.
And it made me so angry that it really helped me develop a relationship with it that was slightly a fuck you to all those people.
Defensive,
who thought that it was superseding my work or that I placed, you know, more value on it than I did other things.
Yeah.
And I've always maintained, and I still maintain, Twitter is where my heart belongs. The stories I uncover and the people that I follow and the ideas that come to me. I don't get ideas from Instagram unless it's like a bathroom tile. So I think for me, the most dangerous actually is WhatsApp. Nancy Jo Sales says in her amazing book, American Girls, The Secret Life of American Teenagers, that girls literally exchange thousands of messages every day. It definitely gives me the most anxiety. I have an actual fear of group messages. I feel a bit sick, honestly, when I think about the one that will be set up for my NCT group. I don't want to be rude, but I also don't want to join.
Let's hope they don't listen.
Well, if they listen, then maybe they'll get an insight into the fact that it's not me wanting to be rude. I just get such anxiety about being answerable to yet another group of people.
I'm exactly the same.
And I'm not the kind of person, unlike my brother on our family WhatsApp groups, to ignore messages. I feel that obligation really keenly. I will always reply. And it's why I airplane my phone and mute it so much, because it honestly is, for me, my worst thing. That said, as you were saying, I think for many people, it's Instagram that's the most dangerous from a mental health point of view, those feelings of FOMO and inferiority, which makes for that very brittle sense of self. I visualise us all as a sort of row of paper dolls creasing in the wind, being punctured by the slightest of cuts, like not getting enough likes on a picture, or someone writing something a bit snarky, like on holiday again, and then you spend the rest of your holiday in a spin that one friend disapproves on how you've spent your fucking annual holiday day, Lance. I mean, it's madness. But that's why I think it's really interesting, and what I was saying about from richer to poorer, is that you can look at social media from a rich, privileged, first world society mental health point of view, like we've just been discussing now with Instagram and WhatsApp. And then you can look at it on a larger scale, a political point of view, like Facebook. And then it can be on a small rural scale, like in India with WhatsApp. There were really many different ways and layers in which social media is dangerous. And actually, that's why I find it so fascinating, to be honest.
I think that's so beautiful, that metaphor that you've just conjured of the paper dolls. And it's so true. As you said, Instagram is dangerous if you become solely dependent on your esteem and self-worth coming from the validation of strangers. As we all know, you can only get that proper strong sense of self and rooting from within yourself, and more importantly, from your actions in daily life. That's how you get your self-esteem. But I agree, WhatsApp is a specific type of hell. As you know, I hate it. I've now turned off all my receipts so people can't see when I'm on or offline, because I found it so stressful.
You're just quite hot or cold with WhatsApp. At some points, you'll have a day where you are loving it, so I jump on board. And we go all day.
You jump on the WhatsApp train.
I jump on the WhatsApp train and we ride along merrily together. And then you go silent for 4 days and I realise that you've moved over to email.
That's so stressful.
I just catch you on different mediums. Sometimes you're more into Twitter, so I'll just talk to you there.
I'm sorry I do that.
Sounds like I follow you around. In fact, I've even been known to direct message you on Instagram. That's less frequent, to be fair. I hate direct message on Instagram. Please don't send me a direct message on Instagram. I'm really bad at checking it, anyone who's listening, but very good on email. I'm comforted by a stat from DigiSpy that I read a few months ago that says that 63% of teenagers wish that social media didn't exist. That leaves me with the hope that the next generation will cultivate a more abstract relationship with social networking. That said, that's not what I see when I read Nancy Jo Sales's book. So different stories from different spheres there.
Yeah, sometimes I wonder if we'll look back on this moment in time, maybe in a period of 10 years, maybe a period of 100 or a few hundred years, and we'll see social media as a strange anomaly in time, and we'll study it as a kind of anthropologically bizarre period where we conflated the virtual and the real.
I think we'll look back on this time and we won't believe that this was ever our reality, because it's not virtual enough.
Really?
The more people who come out and decry the effects of social networking on society and admit that they knew what they were doing to the human psyche and the brain's hardwiring, the more we will self-educate. We might live in a world of increasing augmented reality. I don't quite know how Dolly's going to cope with that. But I think that there will be much more education around the subject, and barriers and boundaries, perhaps even governmental policy. I know that the government are looking into social media platforms having to take responsibility in crimes, bullying, things like that, because there's so little policy around it. That said, I'm going to be strict with my daughter, whatever is around when she is a preteen. A couple of weeks ago on the Hilo, we shared the stat that most parents let their children join social media platforms under the recommended age of 13, and that most of them aren't bothered enough to enforce or to regulate their kids' use or the age at which they join. And well, that won't be me. I'm not saying I'm going to be a Melinda and a Bill Gates, and I do believe in privacy, but my child is not getting a phone age 6, and she is not joining Instagram age 9. End of.
Yes, and Auntie Dolly is going to be bringing her the old Rubik's Cubes and the flower pressing books and the teddies instead of iPads, so don't you worry about that.
It's now time for Ask the Hilo. But believe it or not, we've been gassing for so long, there's no time. But don't despair, because there's going to be a bumper issue of the Ask the Hilo section. Tell us a little bit more, Dolly.
I'm going to comb through the inbox.
Comb.
And I'm going to find the highs and the lows. And
package them up nicely with a
package
bow.
Package them up nicely.
Christmas bow.
And we're going to do a bumper section, as Pandora says, of answering your questions and dilemmas in the Christmas special.
The Christmas special comes out on Thursday, December the 21st. And the New Year's special, because we never miss a week, despite what some of you say, will be on Thursday, December the 28th, with a very special guest. Thank you very much to everyone who listened to episode 38 of The Hilo, or any of the episodes of The Hilo. We're not fussy. Dig in wherever you see fit, like a Christmas buffet. Thank you very much to Acast for letting us use your studio. You can tweet The Hilo at The Hilo Show, or you can email us thehiloshow@gmail.com.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
it. Coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.